Okay, so first I want to talk about fifth forces, by which we mean looking for some extra fundamental force of nature. So I should motivate it a bit. Why would we want to do that? Well, first of all, you know, we've seen four fundamental forces, so it seems quite reasonable that there should be a fifth force of nature, and you know, wouldn't that be very cool? Wouldn't that be really exciting to be the person who finds the new fundamental force of nature, right? So already maybe that's enough motivation and we can stop there, frankly. But let me also say that I think it's, you know, very theoretically reasonable, by which I mean we have no real reason to think there isn't a fifth force of nature. It's very, you know, it's maybe not surprising. We've got this beautiful standard model, as we heard, which is based on our four fundamental forces of nature, right? It's not surprising that it's easy to write down theories that produce these new forces. In fact, we know for every force, what it really means is that there's a boson, there's a particle in the theory that transmits that force, right? So for electromagnetism, there's the photon that transmits the force of electromagnetism. For gravity, there's the graviton. For the weak force, there's the W and Z. For the strong force, there's the gluon. So long as you just have a particle, and we have, you know, excellent ways in quantum field theory to describe that, if you have some new light boson, it'll transmit some new force between the particles of the standard model. So it's you know, easy to write down lots of models that would have a new force. It also certainly comes out as a sort of unintended consequence from many models that we write down for other reasons, for solving other problems. So Alex mentioned in his talk the strong CP problem and how that motivates the QCD axion. So he was talking about looking for the axion as dark matter, which is great. It's a great dark matter candidate. But if the axion exists, if it's in the theory at all, if it's in the Lagrangian of the universe at all, it's a new light particle, a new light boson. It has to transmit a new force. It has to transmit some new long-range force, okay? So I'll spend a little time, for example, telling you what kind of force it transmits and how you can look for that. Or supersymmetry also, not quite as immediately, but also many supersymmetry breaking theories could easily create new forces from light moduli that came along with it. So you might have specific examples of new forces that are motivated even by solving other problems in the standard model. Or also, it's not exactly a fifth force, but I want to lump it in the same category. Looking for a fifth force experimentally is very similar to looking for some modification to gravity, some change to the Newtonian gravity or the laws of gravity that we know about. As I'll show you in just a few slides, often the same experiments are really looking at both some new fundamental force of nature and a change to gravity. And I would say modifying gravity has a very interesting motivation of the cosmological constant problem. So the cosmological constant problem, sometimes people call it the biggest problem in theoretical physics. I asked Jesse and he said he didn't mention it. So then I definitely want to just briefly mention it to you because you should for sure hear about it if you haven't. The basic idea of the cosmological constant problem is we've looked at the expansion rate of the universe and we've measured roughly this energy density filling everywhere, you know, everywhere in space filling the universe, we call dark energy density. That tells us, let me write it down. Let me just call it the cosmological constant, or the CC, has a value which is around milliEV. And it's an energy density, so it's to the fourth. By the way, I should stop for a second and say I'm clearly a theorist because unlike Alex, I definitely will not be using SI units. I'm always going to take h bar equals c equals 1 for the whole talk, okay? So this is energy per unit volume, okay? Units of 4. Mass and distance have inverse units. Okay, so this is the measured amount of energy density that fills our universe and is this weird stuff called dark energy that doesn't clump and doesn't dilute as the universe expands and things like that, right? Drives the accelerated expansion of our universe. So we've measured it, great, so what's the problem? The problem is that when we write down almost any quantum field theory to describe our universe, there are corrections, they're called quantum corrections to this, they're really just contributions to the cosmological constant, okay? So there's things like, by the way, I'll be using the language of quantum field theory a lot. If you're not familiar with it, though, don't worry. We won't really need it. Just sort of accept the results I'm telling you. If these are some standard model particles, the electron or quarks or whatever, running around in some loop, then if I attach some number of gravitons to that loop, it's not completely obvious, but that virtual quantum correction, if you like, corrects the energy density of the vacuum. That gives you some energy density everywhere in space, even without physically putting in particles or anything like that. Okay? And if you calculate those diagrams, you get a very weird result, that they appear divergent, and so their answer would just be infinity. In reality, that's not the way we think about effective field theories, but at least, so we know that instead of giving you milli v to the fourth as the answer, they would give you some much higher number, driven up to whatever I think is the biggest energy scale of particles that could run in this diagram. So a lot of times we theorists think that the fundamental scale is the Planck mass at 10 to the 19 GeV. But even if it's not that, at least, right, I've run the LHC. I've seen that the standard model works beautifully up to around TeV or so, right? So I suspect that physics works the way I know, follows the rules of quantum field theory, and so I should be able to have at least TeV energy particles running this diagram. And then I would get, as a contribution to the CC, it would be something like TeV to the fourth energy density. So, absurdly 60 orders of magnitude bigger than the measured value. Now, these are just contributions to the cosmological constant. So you just have some really big contributions. Some can be positive, some can be negative, no problem. They could, in principle, cancel very, very, very precisely and give you this, but it appears to many of us that extreme fine-tuning, maybe problem isn't quite the right word. It's mathematically allowed. It doesn't exactly contradict data, but it certainly seems like an absurd thing to have happen as an accident. It seems like maybe it's some hint of new physics beyond the standard model. Okay? Okay, any questions on the, that's maybe one of the more important things I'll tell you if you haven't seen it before. Any questions on that before I go on? Okay, yes, please. Did you say if the CC is zero? Yeah, great question. So theorists used to think that, before it was measured, theorists used to think the answer was gonna be zero. For no good reason, though, because we don't even have a theory that would give us zero and agree at all with our observed world, let's say. So even if we hadn't measured it, I'd say it's still a problem. Was that what you were asking? Yeah, absolutely. Although before it was measured, people like to sort of close their eyes to the problem and think, well, it's just going to be zero for some symmetry reason. But that said, many of us theorists have attempted to come up with such a model that would make it zero and failed miserably so far, I would say. I think one of the things that makes this the biggest problem in theoretical, or maybe the biggest problem in theoretical physics, is that so many of us have tried for so long to come up with a solution and so far really no good solutions. Great question. Any other questions? Okay, I just said there's no great solutions, including anything I've written in that. But one that I like, I've always been partial to, even though I would say what there really are ideas for solutions, but nothing that really works. But if we don't have one example of something that really works, we have to go with our best ideas. So one example I've always liked is, well, maybe instead of somehow trying to make it not fine-tuned or put some new physics in, that changes this divergent behavior, maybe I could mess with this vertex right here. Well, gravity, I said we've measured physics up the TeV scale, but we haven't measured gravity up to the TeV scale, right? We've measured all the other forces up to the TeV scale, but gravity, nowhere near that high in energy, nowhere near that short a distance. I'll show you exactly how far we've measured it in just a few slides. So maybe there's something mysterious about gravity, right? There are lots of reasons people have speculated that. So maybe I change gravity in such a way that this vertex gets cut off if it's coupling to particles that are too high energy. This was a beautiful idea that, for example, Raman Sundaram wrote some nice articles about almost 20 years ago now. If that's the case, then I would need to have some modification to gravity, right, at energy scales around here, around milli-EV, right? And since I've set h bar and c equals 1, you can immediately read out what range new force Giorgio should go looking for in his lab, or Peter should go looking for, because milliEV is just about, very roughly, an inverse millimeter. Okay? So that would say gravity should be modified around, very roughly, the millimeter scale or so, maybe a little shorter. Okay? So that's, I would say, another interesting and important motivation for searching for new forces. It's not really a new force, but some change to gravity, some change to the force we know at short distances. Okay? Well, the strength, the strength should be that this vertex shuts off, so I don't get this diagram anymore. So I should lose Newtonian gravity. I'm being exceedingly vague about how that happens because we don't actually have a fully well-defined theory that makes that work. But the strength should be if you try to look, you know, in your lab at the force between two objects closer than roughly that, that I should not see the 1 over r potential of Newton. That's, so 1 times gravity is the strength, but, you know, less than that. Losing that. Good. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, great. Any other questions? Yes. Oh, sorry, yeah. I think the question was whether the zero-point energy has ever been verified. That's what you're saying in any other context. Is that what you're asking? Yeah, it's a great question, and also the answer is one of those annoying answers that isn't exactly what you want, maybe. It's the sort of thing one can discuss at length, and people have many times. I think a classic answer given is that, for example, the Casimir force is sometimes, although it can be viewed simply as a interaction between the electromagnetic structure of the two materials, and that's a completely valid way of looking at it, you can also calculate it absolutely in the same way as the change in the zero-point energy from having your two objects in there. That's one answer. There's probably many other possible answers, but it's never, of course, exactly what you want, because the exact contribution of the CC, there's only one thing the CC couples to by definition, which is the gravity, the expansion rate of the universe. If it couples anything else, it's not the CC. So there's no other way to look for this other than looking at the expansion rate of the universe. Great questions, thank you. Yeah, please keep interrupting me. Let me remember what I was gonna say. I lost my, yes, good. All right, so we want to look for a new fundamental force of nature or change to gravity or something. How do we do it? How are we going to do it? Well, we got to know roughly what it should look like, what we're looking for. So, for example, if we're going to have a new force of nature, I need some new particle to mediate it. Let me take the example of a new scalar. I need some new boson to mediate it. Let me take the example of a new scalar. You could also do a vector or even a spin 2 particle. They give relatively similar phenomenology to what I'll be talking about. So let's just run with a scalar for this lecture. Alex already started mentioning this, but my new scalar, I'm going to call it this, can you see my cursor? No. All right. I'm going to call it this, I'm going to call it phi. And it's got these coupling to psi. Psi is some fermion on the standard model, like the electron or the proton. And this g you should think of as some coupling constant, like Alex was discussing. And roughly, these scalars at leading order have two different possible couplings, what we'll call the monopole, or the scalar coupling, and what we'll call the dipole, or the spin, or the pseudoscalar coupling. And actually, this coupling is the one that Alex was showing in his talk, that the axion naturally has. As well, and I think he'll talk more about looking for this coupling for dark matter tomorrow. Okay, so these are the two possible ways that my new force-carrying particle could couple, right? And so roughly it looks like, all right, I have some standard model particle, the electron or the proton or whatever, coming along, and then it can emit this new phi particle. And if the exact math of it doesn't mean much to you, don't worry about it. I'll tell you what the difference is between these two couplings. But roughly, there's two possible choices for this coupling. which means, right, there's three possible new kinds of forces. So for example, I could have this be the scalar vertex, and this be a scalar vertex. And then if I've got these, this is a Feynman diagram, but if I've got these two standard model particles flying along through space in some direction, they'll exchange this new force carrier. If both these vertices are the scalar force, then you can calculate, or you can see this nice classic paper here, that it creates some potential between your two standard model particles that looks like this, where the G's are the couplings of these. Maybe this is standard model one and two. The G's are the couplings, and you otherwise just get this 1 over R potential with this exponential factor. Okay. So you should think of this. You'll notice, you know, crucially focused, that's a 1 over R potential. So that's a lot like the Coulomb potential or Newtonian gravity or something. So I can certainly, you know, start to picture it as, okay, here's my psi particle. It's an electron or a proton or whatever. And then it's got some, you know, field lines around it. And the fact that these are spreading, as you all know very well, in our three dimensions of space, that's why we get the 1 over R squared force or the 1 over R potential, right? So you could start picturing it that same way. But you know, if you think about two charged particles attracting each other with a Coulomb potential, they're not actually literally, you know, shooting photons back and forth, on shell, real, honest to God photons back and forth between each other, right? These are virtual or off-shell particles. It's the, you know, weirdness of quantum mechanics, right? Same here, that's what's creating this potential, but if this phi has some mass, then in fact it can't be an infinite range force. I can't create these phi particles from nothing and have them live for an infinitely long distance. In fact, at some, this picture I've drawn will kind of break down badly at some distance scale set roughly by 1 over the mass of the new force carrier, and that's this exponential cutoff here, okay? That my force very rapidly dies when it goes beyond the 1 over the mass of the new particle. So this is called a Yukawa potential, and it's sort of a classic thing to look for. There are these other options too, though. So for example, if instead of both of these being scalars, if one of them was a pseudoscalar, then I would get this spin scalar or monopole dipole interaction between these two particles. And just notice something interesting about it. This m2 is the mass of particle number 2, and sigma 2 is its spin. Okay, so crucially, this is a spin-dependent force, right? It's fundamentally looks very different than a simple 1 over r like Coulomb's law or Newtonian gravity or something. This depends on which direction I pointed the spin of particle number 2, okay? So that's interesting, and also notice that it's a 1 over r squared potential. Just as a quick aside, you'll see it's got this 1 over r term, but you'll know that that term, really you should think of it as a 1 over r squared, because you can see if you're at distances that are much less than 1 over m phi, if you're well inside this mass range, right, then this term doesn't matter. It's the 1 over r squared that dominates at short distance, right? So then only, 1 over r squared is dominant. And of course, my distance is much bigger than 1 over m phi, where this 1 over r term would dominate. It's completely irrelevant because it's all killed by the exponential anyway, so there's no force anyway, okay? So you should think of this as a 1 over r squared force. And then finally, if I have two of these pseudoscalar or spin vertices, then I get this dipole-dipole or spin-spin force, and you can see now M1 and M2 are the masses of the two fermions, and it's coupling the spins of the two particles together, so it's dependent on both spins. And you can see it's a 1 over R cubed potential, okay? So sort of thing to keep in mind is that as I have more and more of these spin vertices here, the force is falling off faster and faster with distance, which is one of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that makes it noticeably harder to measure these spin-dependent forces, or at least measure them as precisely, to get to as low a limit on these couplings. And I should say we usually classify them as, for example, scalar versus pseudoscalar because of their parity or parity and time reversal, P and T properties. Both of the monopole-monopole and the dipole-dipole forces would conserve P and T, although the monopole-dipole force, the cross monopole-dipole force, if it existed, would have to break P and T since there's no consistent assignment choice of parity to this scalar that would make both of those vertices conserve it. Okay, so these are the possible allowed new kinds of forces that we'll be talking about. It's sort of a pretty general parameterization of what we might be looking for. Is that clear? Are there questions on that before we go on? Okay, great. So now, how should we look for it? This is really the question for you or for all of us. Let's say as an example, let me say I have this monopole-monopole force, this scalar force, and I have some new, I want to go looking for this. I think my new fundamental force of nature is this scalar-scalar force. How do I search for it? Well, you might say, okay, it's a new force of nature. I should just take two things, two objects, right? Some piece of mass here and some piece of mass here, and hold them and apply some very precise technology that can see how much force is pulling them together. Or, how much it let them go or something and see how much acceleration they have, right? That sounds good. That sounds like a good way to look for a new fundamental force of nature. And then I look around and pick whatever my most precise technologies are, right, and try them. But of course, we've already done that a long time ago, and we called the answer gravity, right? I mean, whatever we saw, we said, that's gravity. That was the name we gave to the force, right? in fact, actually, even much, much stronger than that, if the objects had any charge at all, we called the answer electromagnetism, right? We said, that's the force we see. And then we worked very hard if you wanted to get below electromagnetism. Electromagnetism is a much stronger force than gravity, so if you wanted to get below electromagnetism, you worked very hard to make these objects exactly neutral and put electromagnetic shields and all that in the way. And then, after all that hard work, you could then see gravity, right? Okay, great. But we don't want to discover gravity. We want to discover a new fifth force of nature, right? So we're going to have to do better than that. And in particular, what that means is sort of in much the same way that electromagnetism is a background for gravity, gravity will be a background for looking for this new kind of scalar force. So how can we go looking for it? How can we go looking for it in particular over much of parameter space where we have to look for forces even weaker than gravity? Well, let's see. Let me rewrite this Yukawa potential. It's roughly this 1 over r, e to the minus r, and we usually actually parameterize it as r over lambda, where lambda is 1 over m, the range of this new force. And then we often parameterize the strength of it, not in terms of these dimensionless couplings, but in terms of the strength relative to gravity. Sorry, I should leave it like that. So alpha is some dimensionless number, which tells you how much weaker than gravity this new force is, okay? So how could I go looking for this new kind of force below gravity? Well, there's roughly two different ways. The first is to use the fact that it's got a different dependence on r, right? It's not just 1 over r, it's got this exponential and the potential. So what should I do then? Well, I should take one of these masses and move it around, move it back and forth, or have multiple different masses at different distances or something where I can get at the distance dependence of this, right? That it doesn't look just like a 1 over r squared force law. Okay, so let's say you do that in the lab. You take your two pieces of stuff. You have some distance here between them, right? You move them back and forth or measure, map out the force law as a function of distance over some range in your lab, some order one range, and you have, some amount of stuff here and here, and you have some very precise force meter or accelerometer, some way to see the force between them. What would the sensitivity of that experiment look like? Okay, and in particular, we usually plot it on this alpha lambda plane, the strength of the force versus the range of the force. To start you off, I actually want to ask you in a second to think about it. In fact, I want to ask you to turn to your neighbor and figure it out with them very quickly, because I'm only going to give you like 2 minutes, which is not enough time to actually do it. And in fact, really, I want you to talk to your neighbor, because the most important thing about these summer schools is not listening to old folks, but is getting to know each other, getting to know the other young people, since that'll be, I think, you know, by far one of the most valuable things for your career. But in any case, so I'm going to ask you to figure out what this curve looks like, but let me start you off and say, well, you're probably not surprised that if I move this thing around, whatever the length scale is between my two masses, whatever, let's say it's right here, whatever that is, that's where I'm most sensitive. And let's say at that level, you know, you figure out I have some sensitivity to a force, 10 to the minus 5 of gravity or whatever it is. You figure out, you know, I know how sensitive my apparatus is. So I know this point. I know that I've ruled out new forces that have a strength stronger than alpha at this range. What does the rest of the sensitivity curve look like? Okay, is that question clear? All right, go. Try to talk with, I'll give you like 2 minutes to talk with your neighbor, see if you can rapidly figure out what it is. Okay, sorry to cut you off. I told you I wouldn't actually give you enough time to figure out the answer. but did you figure out even part of the answer? There's one side that's a little easier than the other side. Anyone have a thought about part of the answer? So if not, let me tell you. Really, I just wanted you to start thinking about the shape of the sensitivity curves, because I'm about to show you a bunch in sort of rapid succession. So it helps you have thought a little bit. But I've got some set up in my lab. Maybe it's literally, you know, 10 centimeters apart like this. I'm moving the masses back and forth like this or something, right? If I'm talking, so then this would be, this length scale here would be 10 centimeters or whatever is that distance, right? If I'm looking for forces that are shorter range than 10 centimeters, then my two masses are outside the range of the force, right? And so you can see it cuts off exponentially, right? The strength of the new force cuts off exponentially, so my sensitivity to it must cut off exponentially, okay? Is the left side of that clear? Good. The right side is slightly harder to figure out. But if you look at this, you can say, well, as lambda becomes very big, obviously this goes back to being an infinite range force, right? Just 1 over r. So I know it becomes ever, ever closer to just being gravity, and I can't, with this measurement strategy that I'm talking about right now, I can't tell the difference between this and gravity, right? If there's an infinite range, just by moving this around, the whole thing will look 1 over r. I won't see the difference. So I must want to parameterize the difference between this and gravity. So let's expand. R over lambda is a small number, right? if we expand the exponential, I get 1 minus R over lambda. Or let's expand the whole potential here. This goes like 1 minus R over lambda plus some higher order corrections, all divided by R, right? The first term is 1 over R. That's not useful. The second term, however, is constant. Yeah, the R's cancel here and here, right? So when I differentiate this to make the force, it will give 0. So I know, actually, that it's the order, 1 over lambda squared term that contributes. Okay? So you could write out the next term, but whatever. it's going to be 1 over lambda squared contribution. That's the leading order contribution of the new force. Okay? Is that clear? Question on that? Okay. So therefore, I know that this is going to rise quadratically. Right? It's going like this is an alpha out front, alpha lambda squared. So, you know, as I give up whatever, an order of magnitude in lambda, it must go like two orders of magnitude in alpha. Okay, is that clear? And indeed, that's exactly what you see. So here's the sort of famous plot of all the various different experimental constraints on new fundamental forces of nature that look like this. And this is the strength alpha versus the range lambda. And if you look at the individual curves of all the different experiments, you'll see they do, in fact, follow exactly exponential on the left and quadratic on the right for almost all the experiments. Okay? Yes? Oh, sorry. Okay. So you see what I'm saying here, that I'll have some term that's r squared over lambda squared, right? And this will be the first term, when I divide by r, this will be the first term that leaves me still some change to it, some new piece of the force.
Oh, this is the correction to the force. Okay.
I said it too fast. Let me do it a little more carefully. So this is 1 over r minus 1 over lambda, and then plus some r over lambda. And then I'm going to differentiate this potential with respect to r to make the force. That'll make this 1 over r squared. That'll make this term 0. And then that makes this term a new contribution. And this was supposed to be squared. Does that make sense now? Did that answer the question?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. So it's because of that funny cancellation that your first correction comes in an order lambda squared. And then that's why, if you stare at tick marks for a little while, you can convince yourself that the right sides of all these curves are going quadratically. Okay? Okay, so does that make sense? Yeah, great question, thank you. And in particular also, so for example, let's pick out a few here. The deepest one is LLR, means lunar laser ranging. You know, they deposited some retroreflectors on the moon, and then they bounce lasers off and very, very precisely try to measure the position of the moon with respect to the Earth. And therefore, maybe you're not surprised that if you look at that distance right there, that's just about the Earth-Moon distance, the peak of that curve, right? You're watching the force on that distance scale. That's the best length scale. Or, for example, you can watch the motions of the various planets in the solar system, and we do that, of course, very precisely and have for many, many years. And that makes another excellent way of looking for new fundamental forces of nature, if there's something new beyond a 1 over r of Newton. And sure enough, there's 1 AU right there, okay? That's a couple different planets. That's why it has that funny shape. Okay. All right, good. So we understand this plot, and there's many experiments kind of all put together on this plot. Any questions on that? All right. And I should say, since the title of my lectures was Fifth Forces and Astrophysical Probes, here are your first astrophysical probes, in this case, of fifth forces. Okay. Yes?
Are there any data out to even larger lambdas, like a galaxy or galactic clusters?
Excellent question. Let me get to that in a bit, actually. So leading order, the answer would be roughly no. This is where we have anything precise enough to give a limit on a Yukawa force, except I'm going to spend real time talking about that. Exactly. That's an interesting question. Very good. Yes, thank you. Yeah, great question. Any other questions? Okay. But I want to start, instead of going to large distances, let me start the other way, though, and go to short distances first, since it's near and dear to many of our hearts. So how could I, what's going on here? How can I probe to ever shorter distances? So One example that I think we may not have someone talk about, I was told not to talk much about experiments, so I really won't, and I'm leaving that to the experimentalists, which is better anyway. But just to bring up one example of how you might look to shorter distances, here's an example. So the silvery thing, that's one of my two masses, and the coppery thing, that's the other one of these two masses. And this is the torsion pendulum. This is, for example, a picture of the torsion pendulum in the Etwash group. And you're looking in this case for it's a torsion pendulum, so you're looking for the twist of this silvery mass. And the way you modify the distance, you don't actually wiggle the things farther out and closer together or something, but you can't maybe quite see it. The coppery thing is made of two disks, one smaller and closer, one bigger and farther, and they've drilled holes perfectly to cancel any torque on this upper test mass if the law was exactly Newton, it was exactly 1 over r. But if it's not exactly 1 over r, if there's some lambda in about this size right there, about that range there, right? Then it's not going to exactly cancel, and you'll get some torque. And then, of course, you try to bring, make these as close together as possible to look at as short a range as possible. Okay. And I should say too, obviously, there's many, many other ways to search for new forces. I think you're going to hear about some of them in the talks later this week. So I won't. I'll mostly avoid mentioning much about experiments at all. Here, then, is a zoom in on that plot I just showed you, alpha versus lambda. You'll notice these are now all short distances. This is like 10 microns here, for example. And this is 1 times gravity right there. And so you can see all these different experiments. You'll see the exponential, you just see the exponential curve, the exponential left sides, essentially. If you're talking about a force that's shorter than the distance between those two plates, obviously the sensitivity to it cuts off exponentially. Oops. So there are all these really beautiful experiments that have been pushing down farther and farther, closer, to shorter and shorter distances. I think these Etwash ones and these ones here are torsion pendulum, and you'll hear about others. There's also, I could, continue this plot. There's other iterations of this plot to ever shorter distances. You have to, you're only sensitive to forces ever stronger than gravity. And as I go to shorter and shorter distances, I'm also talking about a mediator whose mass is higher and higher and higher. So I could, this isn't usually done, but I could, in a sense, continue this range of plots all the way up until I get to mediators that are around the weak scale, around the TEV scale, and those are probed, of course, by colliders. Right? We don't actually build physical things in the lab that are fractions of a femtometer close. So colliders even exist on this plot all the way up and to the left. But colliders, of course, are only good at probing forces that are roughly the strength of E and M, or roughly the strength of the weak force. We're talking here about forces much, 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 much weaker than E and M, couplings that are much, much smaller than the charge of the electron. Okay. You'll notice this very important line here, which is 1 times gravity. And you can see currently humanity has probed, has seen that Newtonian gravity is roughly right, down to the shortest length scale of about 40 microns, roughly. I think this is the current limit, although someone correct me if I'm wrong. So as I was motivating right in the beginning of the talk, that's very interesting for the CC problem and other reasons for sure. But for example, this shows this roughly scale of dark energy. I said it was around a millimeter. That isn't exactly right. It's a little bit shorter. But you shouldn't, by the way, you shouldn't take the thinness of these bands seriously. It's a fine-tuning problem. So actually, I would say the motivation sort of stretches out to some extent arbitrarily to the left, although as you look farther left, the CC gets ever more finely tuned. In any case, this is a very interesting region to explore experimentally. Okay. Yes, please. That's the name of an experiment. That's more torsion pendula, I believe. I actually don't know what the acronym stands for, but I believe those are torsion pendula. If someone knows, they can jump in. I think I even found the reference. If you wanted, I can show it to you after, but I didn't get from it what the acronym meant. Yeah, good. Yeah, any other questions on this? All right. Okay, so we've gone to shorter distances. Now, as Alex had asked, what about longer distances? This is not as frequently discussed. In fact, I haven't seen people actually trying to, in any way, shape, or form, extend this plot to the right, although if one of you knows someone drawing it that way, correct me. But you know, just looking at it, maybe this is what prompted Alex's question. It looks a little strange, right? I mean, this thing is going up quadratically, as we learned. This is already at 10 to the minus 1. It's going to hit 1 soon, and I guess what? Keep on going? So are we really saying there could be a force stronger than gravity at those long ranges? Pretty clearly not, right? Because if there's a force even of infinite range, it can't be any stronger than gravity. I mean, we've already seen how the Earth is attracted to the sun, right? I can't have a force of infinite range or even long range stronger than gravity. We've already measured gravity, right? In fact, actually, so I'd say that the plot becomes sort of a bit weird or a bit ill-defined above one there at long range. In fact, if I tried to put in some new force that was over here up and to the right, that was at very long range or even infinite range, but stronger than gravity, I mean, that would just be what we call gravity, yeah? It's not like we have some independent notion of this. We measure GM sun and GM Earth. We measure those very precisely, but we don't have an independent counting of the mass of the Earth or something like that, right? And by the way, I should say, like I said, I haven't actually seen it. I was sort of interested in this just for preparing this lecture because this same question occurred to me. So I haven't seen people discuss it in exactly this language. So the following is simply my speculation for this, for the purpose of this lecture, because I wondered if someone would ask this question, or I wanted to ask this question. What is happening out to the right? What should I fill in out there? I don't think it's perfectly well defined because this plot makes an assumption that I'm looking for an exact Yukawa force or something. In a second, I'll tell you about equivalence principle violation, which is probably really the way to look at long distances. But let's imagine I had a new force that was exactly equivalence principle conserving, but I tried to make it really long range and really strong. What would happen? Well, that would just be gravity, right? Or it would be, even if it wasn't stronger than gravity, it would be some piece of what we call the gravity between the Earth and the Moon or the Earth and the Sun. And so the real question is, do we know that's not gravity? And in particular, do we know gravity is not, since I'm talking about a scalar mediator here, for example, do we know gravity is not mediated by a scalar boson? Do we really know gravity is a spin 2 graviton? Any thoughts about that, by the way, before I tell you my thoughts? Yes? Yes, that's right. And actually, a bunch of people, not just Mond, have talked about scalar gravity, and it works surprisingly well. I mean, we sort of accept general relativity as in spin 2 and stuff. We're taught that in our youth, and therefore it must be true. But actually, yes, scalar gravity works surprisingly well. But there are some issues with it. Anyone have any other thoughts? I'll tell you mine. I think there's lots of issues with it, actually, lots of experimental issues with it. Yeah, exactly. One good one is we've seen gravitational waves, yeah? And they agreed pretty well with the predictions of general relativity. That's one excellent one. We've also measured the bending of light by the sun. That wouldn't happen if I just put a scalar force between nucleons or something. By the way, you could try to make more complicated models that would mock these up, and I have not attempted the exercise of trying to see how close you can get to faking gravity. There's also the precession of Mercury's perihelion, which I believe, I haven't calculated, but I believe works differently if you have a scalar force. I don't think it's the same precession rate. Mm-hmm.
So could you have 10% on large scales be in scalar? Like, we don't have measurements of, like, the power radiated in a LIGO event to that level of precision, do we?
Great question, right? This is exactly when I was preparing this talk. And when you look at this plot, that's exactly what you should think. Wait, what the heck? I mean, you've really drawn this all the way up to 10 to the minus 1, really? I haven't seen anyone address this exactly this way in print, although there are many papers that are tangentially related. And I went down the rabbit hole of reading many of them preparing this talk. But exactly right. I mean, that sounds astounding. Could I have 10% of gravity actually be 10% of what GM sun, by the way, is measured to many digits, you know, 8 digits or something. Could 10% of that actually be something that isn't gravity? It seems incredible. My guess, I mean, you feel free. This is a homework problem for all of you to think about this. The best I could come up with, though, is, well, bending of light by the sun and precession of Mercury's perihelion are like 4 or 5 digits. So I think maybe in some way I should draw a horizontal line like here and say, you know, even out to an infinite range force, I can't have something that makes up more than like 10 to the minus 4 or so of gravity. That's like an extremely rough twiddle. Okay, but maybe there's better, or you know, maybe I'm missing something. Yes.
I don't recall, but the accuracy of G Newton itself isn't that like pretty bad, like 2-3 orders of magnitude of G Newton, and then maybe it's just because it's not about the corrections; it's just about the fact that G Newton itself is not that well known.
Oh, good, absolutely, that's very right. So I'm not gonna talk about it, but absolutely, G Newton itself is not well measured, because what we can measure very well is GM, the combination. To measure G Newton, you have to measure M separately from measuring your force. We can measure forces and accelerations exceedingly precisely, but counting up how many little atoms there are in this piece of stuff is very hard, right? And that's my suspicion. So G Newton, by the way, as you say, is measured poorly, and also there's a famously disagreement between different measurements of G Newton. And my guess about that is, I think many people's guess, is that what's really challenging there is characterizing your source and test masses. So knowing exactly how many atoms you have and where they are and things like that. Although that, you know, what's the right thing to say? Those G Newton measurements, though, don't directly speak to whether it's a scalar or a spin 2. I would still get a 1 over r potential from a scalar. I can still get all that same phenomenology I see of little masses attracting each other. So I think you have to go to something else other than these laboratory tests, like tests of GR or, you know, well, or gravitational waves, things like that. Yes? Excellent, great question, and that leads me to my next point, which is we don't think about what's out here on this plot very much, because although it could be exactly equivalence principle conserving, that seems not very likely, and much more likely is that, in fact, if I have some long or infinite range force, the best way to go looking for it is by some violation of the equivalence principle. So for example, just last week while I was preparing this talk, the microscope satellite came out with this new result. You know, the equivalence principle, right, is I have two different objects and I hold them up and let them fall and see that they fall together. The microscope satellite, for example, did that with, I think it was platinum and titanium falling towards the Earth. And they measured that the relative acceleration between the two was like a few parts in 10 to the minus 15, which is an astounding number, right? So they fell the same. This was also earlier done with other experiments, for example, torsion balances and things like that. Let me get to what I want to say. It's perhaps not impossible, but very unlikely, I would say, or appears very bizarre from the point of view of theory, that some random new scalar that I put in coupling to matter would couple in exactly equivalence principle conserving way. Okay? gravity couples that way, famously, due to, you know, symmetries and leading order, et cetera, et cetera. But if I just write in some new random scalar, it might couple only to, you know, electrons and not to neutrons. It could be massively equivalence principle violating. Or even if I try to write something that couples, for example, theorists write writing forces that couple to baryon number. It wouldn't be a scalar, it would be a vector, but anyway, let's say some U1b coupling to baryon number, so coupling to all the baryons. Still, neutrons and protons don't have exactly the same mass. They differ at a part in 10 to the 3, right, which is a huge difference compared to the numbers we're talking about, the high precision we're talking about. Nucleons have binding energy. Electrons have binding energy. Nothing, if you just, you know, even if you have a force that roughly counts the number of nucleons in your nucleus, it'll approximately conserve the equivalence principle, but only to like 2 or 3 digits. Because of binding energy, because of mass differences, et cetera. At the level of 10 to the minus 15, it would still be, you know, massively easy to see. So exactly, so this is really how you look to long distances. You'll notice though, of course, by the way, they don't, for whatever reason, they don't usually put equivalence principle, they don't usually talk about equivalence principle violations in the same way as a function of distance. So I'll kind of, just graft it onto this plot in a not very fully well-defined way, but you really should. Microscope, obviously, if the range of the new EP violating force, so an equivalence principle violation, by far the best explanation for it, if we do see it, would be some new force of nature that simply isn't gravity, right? Like E and M violates the equivalence principle. Every force that isn't gravity that we've seen violates the equivalence principle. But if that new force was shorter than the radius of the Earth, then obviously microscope doesn't actually get 10 to the minus 15 precision, right? They're only seeing some piece of the Earth, whatever piece of the Earth is within the range of the force. So if I was to kind of very roughly label an EP test on this plot, it might look something like this, where this cutoff is roughly the radius of the Earth, right? And then as you get to shorter distances, I see less and less and less of the Earth until it precisely cuts off at whatever, for example, with microscope, whatever height microscope is above the surface of the Earth. If the force gets shorter range than that, then there's no source mass at all for microscope's test masses. So when you hear about an EP test, you should really, in your mind, put it on as a function of distance, something like this. This is obviously, you know, I drew this very roughly with Keynote, right? But so don't take this seriously. But okay. Okay, so the equivalence principle is really sort of the kind of probably the right way to go looking for very long or even infinite range forces. Even if it's infinite range, I'm not using the fact that it's got this different distance dependence. I'm using the fact that it couples differently to different masses. Okay, any questions about this before I go on? All right. Okay, now there's one very important, let me just check what's next. Yeah, okay. Let me just mention, so far I've been talking all about scalar forces. I can also, it's very interesting also to look for these spin-dependent forces. I really won't talk much about that. Maybe you'll hear more later, but let me just mention, since I showed you the torsion pendulum already, let me mention that you can also make spin-polarized torsion pendulum, or one way or another, in your lab, you want to control some spins, you know, point them in different directions, et cetera, and see that there's some new force that depends on your spin, right? That depends on which way your spins are pointing. And then, so this is, for example, for the spin-polarized torsion pendulum, you can search for forces in some range like this. So this is, again, the strength of the force, that pseudoscalar coupling GP squared versus the range. They've reversed it now. This is in mass, but that's just 1/distance, so you just have to flip it if you want it in your head, if you want it in distance. And you can see this is, so 10 microEV is something like 10 centimeters or something. So this is looking for forces on that scale of 10 centimeters and lower masses, which means longer distances. And notice, of course, this can go flat out to arbitrarily long distances because it's looking for a spin-dependent force, right? We don't have something else that fakes that. All right. However, there's one kind of very important point, which is if I have a new fundamental force of nature, then I said I have to have a new particle which mediates that force, right? If I have a new particle which mediates that force, it can do something other than be exchanged virtually between test masses in my lab. In particular, if I've actually got a new particle, you know, we should, you know, like the particle physicists have always wanted to do, we should just produce the damn thing. I should just see it, right? So if I have a new force carrier, I could also just radiate it, right? And in particular, my experiment here, if I'm taking some chunk of matter and shaking it, it will actually just radiate this particle. So long as I'm shaking it at a frequency which is above the mass of the particle or something, I will just spit out this particle. And so there's a whole separate class of probes that look for that. I won't talk about that much, but I would say these famous light through walls experiments are in that category. So I should just at least briefly mention the way that works is, now it turns out it's not super useful to shake an actual mass in the lab. You can try it, but our limits on new forces are far too strong to make an experiment like that, to try to radiate from mass like that interesting. But there are things I can shake, and you know with radiation, you know, think back to your Larmor formula or whatever, the faster I shake something, the stronger I radiate, right? The more power I radiate out. There are things I can shake very fast, which are electrons, right? So if I have something coupled to electrons or something coupled to the electromagnetic field, these are all the kinds of couplings Alex was talking about in his talk, then I can produce devices which shake things very fast and radiate that new particle a lot, right? So the kind of, theorist toy example that you should have in mind is some electromagnetic cavity, all right? And I can wiggle the electrons in the walls, wiggle the electromagnetic field very quickly. So if it's coupled to electrons or if it's coupled to the electromagnetic field, to FF dual like Alex was talking about, I might radiate out that new force-carrying boson. And now it wouldn't be a virtual particle, it would be real, on-shell, actually shooting out quanta of energy, okay? And then maybe I'll put another microwave cavity over here and detect it, because electromagnetism, you know, I have some great shielding between them. Electromagnetism is not supposed to get through the wall, but this new particle is so weakly coupled, it does get through, and it can excite the other cavity. And this is essentially what these famous light through walls experiments are doing. They're shining a laser through a laser is a rapidly oscillating electric field, right? Through this some strong magnetic field, they have some wall in the way. They're looking for the axion or some other light particle like that to be produced, go through, and be read out on the other side. So you see light somehow miraculously shining right through a wall. Okay, so those are a lot of fun and neat experiments. And they'll put some limit. So this is a very complicated plot. I didn't find a better plot for it. But roughly, again, this is the coupling versus the mass. And if you look it's hard to see, but if you look at this dashed line here, you'll see the projection for this famous ALPS-2 experiment, which is happening. And you can see it's going to arbitrarily, going flat to arbitrarily low masses, because once, and it cuts off, it certainly has to cut off at masses that are above the energy you have available, above the frequency at which you're shaking something, right? You can't radiate a particle if its mass is heavier than that frequency. But it goes flat below it, because once the mass is lighter than the frequency you're shaking it, it really doesn't matter. It's mostly massless in this experiment, right? The mass is irrelevant. I'm just radiating out relativistic quanta of this particle. So it's a nice technique that can look over sort of all longer range. Forces are all longer range, are all lower mass particles. So you might call these light through walls, or sometimes they're called transmission experiments. And there's several of different kinds, and you can look for different couplings even. You could look for coupling to fermions, or you look, this one looks for coupling to the electromagnetic field. Okay, so that was more or less where I wanted to stop. That was kind of all about fifth forces, but in particular, though, I want to leave you something for a lot of what tomorrow's lecture will be is, if I have this fifth force, I just said I can radiate the particle, right? Well, if I can radiate the particle, there may be other limits on it, or other ways to look for it, and in particular, that's where we'll really get to talking about astrophysics. Astrophysical objects make excellent radiators of these new particles. Okay, so that's sort of the thing to keep in mind for tomorrow's lecture, that if I have this new force, I also have a particle, necessarily have a particle associated to it, and then I should ask about its consequences for all sorts of different environments, and in particular, astrophysics will be very strong. Let me stop there and see if there's any questions.
That was a great talk.
Thanks.
I'm an experimentalist, and so I can't help but ask some more of an experimentalist question.
Please.
But it has more to do with the exclusion plot that you plotted, that you showed, like with the LLR data. And the thing that has me perplexed is like, you don't know what the mass of the Earth or the Moon is very well. So how do you, how do they? What are they measuring, and then how did then they get to that?
Very good. Yeah, you know what? Sorry, I forgot to say that. That's a great question. Thank you. That's really important. Absolutely. So, for example, let's say I'm looking at one of these planetary exclusions of the Moon. I'm looking at, you know, how the Moon orbits the Earth, or how Mercury orbits the Sun, or whatever. We measure the precise shape of the orbit absurdly well, right? I mean, we've been doing it for years. We can really measure the positions of the planets very, very well. GM sun, of course, is a fit parameter in that. I don't know the mass of the sun, right? So it's not that I'm looking for some extra little contribution on my calculated exactly how strong gravity should be. No, right? That's not it at all. I don't know how strong gravity is. I'll let GM sun float. Instead, I'm looking for the different distance dependence. I'm looking for the fact that it's not a 1 over r, and so if you write down orbits in this potential, you know, just do your classical orbital dynamics in this potential versus a 1 over r potential, they're different. And all of these masses aren't, you know, the planets are not on exactly circular orbits, right? They move in, they do move in and out. So they are sort of my prototypical experiment. I'm testing different distances. So I can see that the orbit shape is not exactly, or I would have been able to see that the orbit shape is not exactly that of a 1 over r potential if there was some new force in that range, exactly. Did that answer the question?
Kind of, but does that mean you can use, like, you know, the astronomers, you know, during, you know, 5 centuries ago, can you use their measurements and predictions, and then compare them to, like, you know, where the sun and Earth are now, and that long baseline of time? Does that then help you do a better?
That's a great experiment. That's a really interesting idea. That's as far as I know. So I should say I have not actually worked on this. I've not set these bounds or anything. So I certainly don't know all the details. As far as I know, that's not how they set these bounds. They just look at, you know, modern data. I don't know if it would. It's an interesting, really interesting question. If it would help to have a very long time baseline versus very high precision data that we have today, I guess that the high precision we have today is probably better enough to outweigh that. And then, of course, with a long time, you have to correctly model all the different effects going on in the solar system to many digits, so that's not trivial, right? We don't know everything, so my guess is that wouldn't help, or it wouldn't, it, you know, it set a much worse limit than we have here, let's say. But I don't know for sure.
So unfortunately I missed the last interaction because they gave me the microphone and as an experimentalist I started trying to figure out what's inside, so I got distracted. But I just wanted to add one thing. You see, there is, Peter, help me, right? But I mean, the two little dips there.
Which here?
Yeah, right. So the reason why there's no more dips is that things are either too far, like Jupiter is farther away, but it's so slow that we haven't seen more than, I don't know, you haven't seen very many orbits. So looking at the, for instance, precession of the perihelion is just not, you know, it doesn't give you a very good measurement. And then one of the planets has almost, I forgot whether it's Venus or Mars, it has almost exact, has no eccentricity.
Right, it's so very close to
circular. So determining which way the perihelion points is very hard. And that's why there are more of those sort of dips in that structure. Okay? I don't know if that adds anything to the discussion.
Yes, but yes. I believe that's right. Yep.
Okay. Can I do it?
So in all these plots, it seems like we have absolute value of alpha on the vertical axis. Would the sign of alpha ever matter? Would it ever help that, say, its opposite direction is gravity? Would it be helpful ever?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can't think of something when it helps because these are just tiny corrections. So they you know, push the orbit in some slightly different way, but it's all still some tiny fraction of your, you know, of your gravitational force. So it's just some tiny correction to the orbit of the planet, or it's some, you know, new force or something that I'm looking for. So I can't immediately think of something where the sign helps, but I could be missing something. Good question.
Sorry, does the sign of the coupling, like the sign of the fundamental coupling, GS, that gets squared going into the Yukawa potential.
So very good. Yeah, so this is something, yeah, I meant to mention, it didn't. So for a scalar exchange force, let's go back to it. For this scalar exchange force, you can see when it's between identical particles, then I have the exact same coupling. It's squared, and then it's always attractive. So there's this famous law that a scalar force is always attractive. That's actually only true between exactly identical particles. Between two different particles, the scalar force could certainly be repulsive because the couplings could have different signs. But exactly, between identical particles, the scalar force is always attractive. Though, of course, as you know, I could have a massive vector that transmits a new force, you know, a B minus L coupled vector or something transmits a new force.
Sure. I'm just saying for the plot you're showing, like the Earth and the Moon are pretty similar stuff.
Yeah.
So like that force I think you know is going to be
attractive. If it's mediated by a scalar, those are exactly going to be attractive. Exactly. I could make up other, you know, this I should say, I mean, I talked about scalar, but this plot will really apply to, you know, mediation by a vector or you know, other forces like that, so long as it's a 1 over R, so long as it's a Yukawa type potential, yeah.
Thank you. I'm wondering about other types of mediations. For example, pairs of scalars or pairs of fermions that can mediate long-range forces.
Interesting question. So, okay, depends what you mean. So do you mean I have something like this,
yes.
where I always have to exchange two or something? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, great question. Someone may remember off the top of their head. What happens with this, I believe, is you get much higher powers of R. So it's not a 1 over R potential or a 1 over R squared force. It's some higher power. I don't remember the power right now off the top of my head. Anyone remember, by the way? Okay. But yeah, so those turn out to be much harder to look for because of this much higher power of R. They fall off much more rapidly. So you should essentially, you know, think of our, we're always working as hard as we can to get our source mass and our test mass as close as possible if we want to do this short-range test. But it's very, you know, it's difficult to get them extremely close. And so when it falls off like a higher power of R, you suffer more. It's harder to look for. It's also actually one of the reasons that these, where did they go? There. The spin-dependent forces. So I didn't plot these on the same units at all. But if you did, you'd find that in some absolute sense, the kind of new force you can look for with the spin-dependent forces are much stronger than the force you can look for you know, you have much weaker limits on the spin-independent forces than you have on the spin-independent forces, because they fall off like the higher power of R.
I mean, the reason I asked this is because we already have one example of that with if we have a massless neutrino exchange.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never see it, I guess.
It's a great thought, and I think that's why you've never seen it. That it's a much harder. It's a cool thing, and if we can, I spent a little time one time trying to think of ways to look for it. But as far, let's say, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it. But as far as I'm aware, what seemed to stop me was that it was difficult to get an interestingly accurate enough test, an accurate enough test to be interesting because of this faster fall off with R. Yeah.
So there's a paper that came out last week that claims you can measure this around neutrino reactors because of the background.
Okay.
It's actually 1 over R.
Cool. I'll have to check it out. I've not seen it. But yeah, definitely an interesting thing to think about, for sure.
Hi. I have a very general question, different from all of this here. So in general, when we want to do like thermodynamics of gravitating systems, let's say stellar clusters, it's difficult to do because of long-range interaction and the system is non-extensive. But if you have short-range forces like this, I mean, do you think it'll be easier to do thermodynamics of those systems and we can solve a few open questions? I mean, just a random question. Yeah.
I might not be totally sure what you mean. So do you mean that if I had some system interacting like only with this new force or something, that it would be?
Yes. So I mean, for example, you have a long-range force and you have a short-range. It might make just dealing with thermodynamics analytically easier because you can do a bit of extensive statistics, which is not generally possible because of purely long-range interaction.
I haven't thought about it. It's an interesting question. Mostly we're talking about very, very weak, or let's say the limits have already set us in a regime where these forces are very, very weak.
All right.
So I think, you know, any real it might be interesting from a sort of toy theoretical point of view, but any real system, the forces that were that are left unexcluded are exceedingly weak.
Right.
So it may be, let's say, difficult to even see any effects of them.
But for very large lambda, if alpha is large enough, there may be very small, I guess, evidences there.
Yes, although, as I said, we do have this equivalence principle test and things like that. So, it's hard. It's hard to maybe make a very strong force.
With no more questions, let's thank Peter again.